This is Paul Shannon introducing another in the series of programs dealing with the thrilling adventures to be found in the field of scientific research, as told by the men of science themselves. Today's story by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories, is an anniversary tribute to a man who contributed much to the power and the glory of America, George Westinghouse.
It is 1866. Another war has come to an end. A horrible conflict, not between nation and nation, but between brothers of the same nation. The Civil War is over, and on the ashes left by the dying fire of hate, America must build a new and better future. As the songs of battle fade into the past, a new song is born, a song of whirring wheels, of machines. A new era of industry is dawning, and a new way of travel to replace the covered wagon.
How far are we from
California? How far? Well, now, that all depends on how you look at it.
What do you mean?
Well, if you mean how far in hope, I'd say we were practically there already. But if you mean in miles, it's pretty far off. Get up there!
Pa, do you think there ever will be any way to go to California outside of on a wagon?
I don't know. Those fool steam locomotives might be some good. But I'll take the wagon any time instead of riding one of them railroad trains.
Why, Pa?
Well, for one thing, they don't travel out this far. And besides, they ain't safe. It's easy to stop horses in a wagon, but a heavy train of 5-6 cars is something else. Now, there's been too many wrecks on the railroad.
But I tell you, sir, this brake of mine will stop a train. I'll prove it to you if you let me.
Don't make me laugh, Mr. Westinghouse. No railroad will let you have equipment to prove something that is only a fanciful dream. Imagine stopping a train with wind.
But I tell you, this is what the railroads need. A brake that will give the engineer control of the train, instead of relying on the braking crew to stop it.
There is no doubt about it. If such a break could be made and perfected, it would give the railroads what they need, a real chance to grow. Yes, there's no doubt about it.
Let's try.
And so the new break gets its chance and proves itself. George Westinghouse's air break is destined to shape a new era for America. But even as the first air breaks are being made and improvements added in the Westinghouse plant at Pittsburgh, a gold spike is being driven to join the rails of the Pacific Road. The first transcontinental railroad line at Promontory Point, Utah.
That's the last fight, boys!
I want a ticket to Chicago, please.
What's the train fare from here to Kansas City?
By boat? Oh, heavens no. I'm going to go by train.
Throughout America, the wheels are rolling. The trains are getting longer, carrying more passengers, helping America to grow, to build newer cities beyond the thriving young city of Chicago, out to the great far west. They're getting longer, they're rolling faster, and they'll stop where the engineer wants them to, when he has to stop.
It's really eyeballing now, Tom.
Yeah, with 23 cars rolling right along, too.
You know, when I first started engineer, I never thought I'd be carrying a load like this.
Or going as fast, either.
Or being sure I could stop. The man who invented this air brake was powerful smart. Powerful smart.
And while new cities grow to the west, dwellers in New York and Boston and Dartmouth and Columbus are finding new contributions of the iron monster of the rails with its newfound brakes of air.
Good morning, Mrs. Grant.
Oh, good morning. I was looking at this. What is it? A new kind of vegetable?
Oh, that's oranges from out in California. You ought to try some. They're delicious, juicy as can be.
You mean they grow these out in California?
Yes, and they ship them here in these new refrigerated railroad cars. Keep things wonderful, they do.
Yes, the rails are humming. America is growing. And industries, new industries, are growing with it.
Biggest year the meat packers have had yet.
Those railroads sure can haul the freight. How can we do without them?
We'll have to expand our plant. Next year, the railroads figure to need more steel rails than ever in history. They'll mean a big thing to us if we can supply them.
The market's up in textiles and shoes, higher in wheat and other grain, too.
I saw half a trainload of reefers going out to Kansas only this morning.
America is moving on rails, building on rails, thriving as she grows. And again, the mind that conceived the air brake, searching for new needs, sees in railroading the urgent demand for a system of safe signaling to control the ever-increasing traffic.
They have something like it in England, but here's the logical answer. An interlocking signal and switching mechanism powered by compressed air.
Another creation of Westinghouse genius to speed the trains on their way, safely on the open road, safely in the tangled terminal yards. Switches and signals that men need not set by hand. Perfect powered control of America's main arteries of transportation. Yes, it's a wonderful America now, with its trains and telephones, its bicycles with the big front wheels. It's a new age we're living in, a plush and gilded age, with new speed and lighter labors. Lighter nights, too, with electric lights. But there's considerable speculation about using electricity for power.
Steam. Steam is your only source of power.
Electricity ought to be put to use.
Well, it's fine for lighting a few of those lamps, but it isn't practical.
That's right. You can generate enough for the lights, but you can't carry the power very far from the generator.
If I had more power, I could turn out twice as much steel.
Give me more power, and I'll make enough shoes for everyone in the New England states. Give me power. Power.
Power.
Power!
In Pittsburgh, George Westinghouse turns his agile mind to the solution of the problem of power. Sinks a gas well in his own backyard. Takes out 28 patents on gas control and distribution devices to furnish an inexpensive fuel for power to replace coal. But manufacturers all over the eastern states are crying for still more power. More lights are burning by electricity. More motors running. But electricity for power just won't travel over any distance.
Yes, it will. There's a way. Instead of generating current that goes in only one direction, make it go back and forth through the wire. You can carry it on for miles that way.
Who says so?
That's a laugh. That's alternating current. The voltage is too high. Kill you, like that.
No one wants that stuff.
I need power. Try AC.
Another new melody in America's song of progress. The humming of an alternating current generator. George Westinghouse moves ahead in the face of all the disagreement. The first AC system is installed to light the main street of Great Barrington, Massachusetts.
Tarnation, Hetty, the town's gone plumb wild over that display of electric lights last night.
I know, but isn't it wonderful?
Yeah, in a way it is. Old Doc Jackson was driving right down Main Street when they started the generator going out at the old mill. Scared his horse so, them lights coming on like that. He bolted, and old Doc couldn't get a stop for half a mile.
They say it's very dangerous, electricity.
Well, I heard the Westinghouse men say it ain't so. The other fellow from up at Massachusetts Tech says different. A man don't know what to think to hear someone pro and con.
Pro and con. Yes, indeed. While the argument raged, George Westinghouse and the men who worked with him carried out their research in the field of alternating current. With Nikola Tesla, he developed the polyphase AC motor. And the newspaper shouted,
paper, electric lineman killed at work. Read about the corpse in the wires. Paper, one more lineman roasted
dead. Obviously, we must return to the use of gas. Electricity is far too dangerous.
I insist. The only practical source of power for factories and for illumination is alternating currents.
Dear attention, ladies and gentlemen, step up and buy your tickets now. See the most marvelous, the most wonderful dance and sensation of the age, Little Egypt.
Hey, ride the Ferris wheel, the only vertical ride in existence. See the entire world's fair in a glance as you glide through the sky like a bird.
It's 400 years since Columbus landed in America. And here is America commemorating the achievements of all those years in the magic splendor of the Columbian Exposition. Here is all the world on display, and the glory of it is crowned by another step to a greater future. The entire fair is bathed in the light of thousands of electric lamps installed by George Westinghouse
and powered by the Westinghouse alternating current generators, specially built and on display in the fair's marvelous machinery hall.
Mama, what are those big machines?
They're electricity machines, honey. Now stay back here with Mother and don't be climbing all over that iron railing.
What's electricity, Mama?
It's what lights all these electric lights at the fair.
Does electricity come out of the machines?
Yes, dear.
I don't see it.
Of course you don't. It runs along the wires.
It does?
Yes, dear.
But you said you can't see the electricity.
Well, you can't see it.
Well, then how do you know it runs along the wires?
Oh, for goodness sake, must you ask so many questions? Come along. The people are looking at you and laughing.
But I want to see the electricity, Mommy. You said it runs, and if it runs, I want to see the...
Hundreds of years, Niagara, giant among waterfalls, has poured billions of tons of valuable water over its foaming crest, dashed it against the rocks below, where it rushed down the river to the sea. Niagara, a wonderful place for a honeymoon, the favorite spot of couples newly married. Now, men of vision cast a far-seeing eye upon it, and see in Niagara's rushing water a source of energy. Energy to manufacture electricity.
A wonderful source of power. If we could harness our source, make it generate electricity.
You have no use for all the electricity that you generate.
Well, not at Niagara, perhaps, but... Well, there's Buffalo, and there's all upstate New York.
Oh, yes. Try and get it from Niagara Falls to those places.
The use of alternating current, proven practical at the World's Fair, is certainly the answer to the problem of carrying power.
Can you make it work at Niagara?
Can you make it work?
Can you?
The answer comes... 3 seconds after midnight on November 16, 1896, when, generators installed and tested, the circuits are closed, and Niagara lights the city of Buffalo, 20 miles away. Niagara is at work, thanks to the genius of George Westinghouse.
There's power at Niagara Falls.
Power at Buffalo. Bring the plant to upstate New York.
Carborundum, aluminum, electrochemical plants, new industries for America, new jobs for America. New useful products for the markets of America and the world. The contributions to transportation and power continue. George Westinghouse takes out hundreds of patents and doesn't stop even then.
Subway trains.
Elevated trains. Electrified railroads.
The new steam turbine for steamships.
Elevator systems for the rising forest of skyscrapers.
Speed.
Safety. Power.
That is the power, and this the glory.
If someday they say of me that in my work, I have contributed something to the welfare and happiness of my fellow men, I shall be satisfied.
And this is the glory, the only glory George Westinghouse ever asked.
And that's today's anniversary story by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. Join us again next week for another story by Dr. Thomas on Adventures in Research. In Research.
My watch is 10 seconds fast.
Well, maybe the clock is slow.
Oh, no.
Why,
that's Big Ben.
This is Paul Shannon introducing another in the series of programs dealing with the thrilling adventures to be found in the field of scientific research, as told by the men of science themselves. And here is your guide along the way, Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories.
Thank you, Paul. Hello, everyone. This is the story of a clock. Not an ordinary everyday clock, but a deep-voiced friend, strengthener and counselor to many people throughout the world. A clock with a history, with a voice that speaks of courage, of hope and liberty, of unshakable firmness of purpose. Moreover, this particular clock has a name, Big Ben. You've probably heard the voice of Big Ben over your radio many times and thought nothing of it. But if you, an American, happen to be in London, England, listening to the great hour bell atop the clock tower of the House of Commons...
My watch is 10 seconds fast.
Well, maybe the clock is slow.
Oh, no. Why, that's Big Ben.
Well, so what? It can be wrong like any other clock, can't it?
Not Big Ben. Why, people all over the country, throughout the British Empire, in fact, set their watches and their lives by Big Ben.
Say, maybe you can tell me. How come it's called Big Ben? It's a funny name for a clock. And how long's it been there? Centuries, I guess.
Hardly. It wasn't christened until 1859. And even then, it was done as more or less of a joke.
Well, sounds like a swell story. Let's hear it.
Well, it all began, really, after the burning of the old Houses of Parliament. Around 1844, while the new buildings were under construction, Parliament decided that a clock should be a permanent feature in the design. In fact, as one member put it...
And furthermore, it should be a noble clock. Indeed, a king of clocks. The biggest the world has ever seen. Within sight and sound of the throbbing heart of London.
Brave words and a big promise, which proved to be somewhat difficult to fill. The best clockmaker in the country was called in, given instruction.
Now, here are the specifications. The new clock must run for 8 days. Show the time on 4 dials, each to be 30 feet in diameter. It must strike the 4 hours on 8 bells, and strike the hours on a bell weighing 14 tons.
In due course, the clockmaker submitted a design, but it was turned down. 2 years of wrangling followed. Finally, the house appointed the Astronomer Royal, George Airy, to obtain designs and estimates. He was a man who was not easily satisfied, and two of his demands staggered the clockmakers.
And in addition, the first strike of the hour bell should register the time correct to within 1 second per day.
1 second?
Furthermore, it should telegraph its performance twice a day to the Greenwich Observatory, where a record could be kept. Any comments, gentlemen?
Such a standard may easily be reached by observatory timepieces working under ideal conditions, that's true. But it's another matter for a clock whose hands are exposed to wind and weather.
Such a demand is impossible.
Utterly impossible.
Nevertheless, those are the conditions, gentlemen. Such a clock could and should be made. How or by whom, I am unable to say at this moment. It is not impossible.
That sure sounds like trouble all the way around.
Yes, and it was. The matter dragged on, the clock experts insisting it was an impossibility. The House of Commons still wrangling, and the public waiting for their clock. Then in 1851, Edmund Beckett Denison took charge.
I suggest, Mr. Airy, as Astronomer Royal, I'm sure you'll agree with me, that Mr. Dent, who's an expert chronometer maker, is the man to do this job. We'll call him in, give him the specifications, and get the work going.
Thus, in 1852, work began in earnest. But more troubles ahead.
I regret that for family reasons, I, George Airy, am forced to resign my post as Astronomer Royal.
The death of Mr. E.J. Dent, chronometer maker, is announced.
That leaves me alone with a mass of machinery in front of me and a host of hostile critics behind me.
A nice spot to be in, all right. Now, what happened next?
Denison went to work, assisted by Dent's stepson, Frederick, and in 1854, was completed. 5 years before the tower, which was the Heriot, was ready. So, for years, the clock lay in the workshop, continually watched and tested. One problem, however, remained unsolved. The costing of the 14-ton hour bell.
It's too big a casting job for me to handle, Mr. Dennison. No bell that size has ever been cast in this country. Besides, the specifications you demand are too severe.
Sorry, Mr. Dennison. Biggest casting we've ever done was the great bell at York Minster, 10 3/4 tons.
Well, I'll try it, Mr. Dennison. Biggest casting I've ever attempted, but I'll do the best I can.
The bell weighing 14 tons was made, shipped to London by steamer, and hung on a special gallows erected for testing purposes. A hammer weighing 3/4 ton swung against the bell, and it promptly cracked.
They sure were having troubles. It's a wonder they just didn't give up about that time.
More delay followed. Finally, George Mears of Whitechapel, whose firm had been bell caster since 1570, undertook the task, completed it, and on April 10th, 1858, the bell that was to become Big Ben was cast and passed its tests. It took a week to hoist the great bell and its 4 satellite bells into position by manpower. Then the clock was assembled, and at last the task was finished, and everyone eagerly awaited the long-promised chimes and tolling of the hours. But...
more trouble?
Yes. The clock refused to go.
I really don't understand it at all, Mr. Dennis.
All right.
It's a question of weight, gentlemen. Hands of the clock weigh 2.5 ton. They're too heavy for the drive machinery. I propose to substitute lighter hands, and then I think our troubles will be over.
On May 31st, 1859, 15 years after Parliament decided there should be a clock in the new house, Big Ben came into his kingdom. But there was still one last problem.
This special sitting of the house has been called for a special purpose. To christen a new giant baby. The huge clock which now so gracefully adorns the tower of this equally now failed House of Commons. No doubt each member present has thought of an appropriate name, and we are ready to consider suggestions.
Mr. Speaker, I suggest it be called the New House Bell.
Apparently the name is displeasing to certain members.
I suggest the clock be called the Victoria in Her Majesty's honor.
Or simply the Commons Clock.
Why not call it the Parliamentary Clock?
Or the Great Clock.
The Queen's Clock.
Throughout that hot summer afternoon, the name suggestions and the wrangling which followed each suggestion went on until finally...
Mr. Speaker!
The House recognizes Sir Benjamin Hall.
Mr. Speaker, members of the House of Commons, sir, we are gathered here to christen the most important addition to this historic house, within whose walls... What?
Oh, may as well settle back. Big Ben's got into his stride.
Yes, he'll talk for an hour, I wager. And say nothing at all, the old windbag. No wonder they call him Big Ben.
...to find a name which will be both suitable and dignified, as befits such a noble clock. A veritable king of clocks. And so on this historic occasion, let us ponder carefully upon the selection of a suitable name for the clock. A name which will be spoken fondly by our posterity.
Why not call it Big Ben and be done with it?
It has been suggested that the new clock be christened Big Ben. All in favor, say aye.
Aye!
Opposed? Carried unanimously. The name of the new clock shall henceforth be known throughout England as Big Ben.
So that's how Big Ben got its name, after Sir Benjamin Hall. I've often wondered about that. Well, I guess all their troubles were over at last.
Not quite. There were still teething troubles. 2 months after Big Ben was put into service, his voice broke.
Well, treatment, that's what caused it. I made this bell, and it's cracked under too heavy a hammer.
Lighter hammer will fix it, I'm sure.
Well, partly. But we'll have to chip a piece of metal out of the sound box and turn the bell just a little.
Very well. See to the fitting of a lighter bell hammer. Give the bell about 1/8 of a turn. See what that does. Splendid! I don't believe we'll have any more trouble with Big Ben.
At last their troubles were over. Is that the Big Ben we know today?
Yes, but if Big Ben, the great hour bell, is unique, so is the clock that drives him. The weights for the chimes and striking alone weigh about 2.5 tons.
Oh, that's a lot of weight, all right. How do they work? The weights, I mean.
They're hung by wire ropes, descending almost to the ground as they run down. And you know, in those early days, the work of winding was done by hand. It took 2 men 8 hours, twice a week, to do it. Today, modern electric motors wind them 3 times a week.
So Big Ben's gone modern.
Yes, and through all weather and conditions, through peace or war, Big Ben keeps time. As he has grown older, his character has developed. His influence spread. But always his big feature has been the correct time. Exactitude. Dependability.
With the coming of radio, the voice of Big Ben has spread farther afield. The voice is heard in the far-off corners of the earth, in the backwoods, the lonely islands, on ships sailing in distant seas, deep, sonorous tones that seem to say, "This is Big Ben calling. Time to check your watches."
Thank you, Dr. Thomas, for a grand story. The history of England's world-famous clock, Big Ben, was told by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. Join us again next week when Dr. Thomas will be back with another interesting story to tell on Adventures in Research.